This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
And I tell you what, it was one of the very first true viral emails that went worldwide. These days with competition, any little edge can connect. Technology innovation has helped improve a lot because the quality of the product has lifted up substantially.
No, I'm not a big pizza in bed girl.
Welcome to the Simon Dell Show, episode number 28. It is Monday, the 11th of June, and welcome back to the show. Thank you very, very much for tuning in. As you may know, this show is where it's broken into two parts. We have the spin cycle part that you'll hear in a moment with this week with Dr. Edwina Luck, as usual. But Kim O'Gorman joins us again because Patrick is off gallivanting around the US chasing some politician around. The politician knows he's there. It's not like he's doing some sort of stalking thing. The second part of the show is an interview. Now, this week I have quite possibly the biggest interview. No, actually, that's a bit unfair on everyone else I've interviewed. Let's say they're all up there on a level. We have a gentleman by the name of Glenn Cooper, who is the chairman of, and you may be able to guess by his surname, Cooper's Brewery. So I do, of course, reveal to him that I used to work for Lion Nathan, which he then finds obviously hilariously funny and promptly spends most of the episode giving me shit about that, which is absolutely fine. But it's a fascinating story about his rise through entrepreneurship, starting his own business and then moving back into the family business, and how that business operates and brings family members into it at a certain age. So fascinating story from Glenn. And as a side note, although not really a side note, he is also the chairman of an organization called Australian Made. Now, if you've ever bought anything that has been manufactured in Australia, you'll see that it has the little kangaroo triangle symbol on it. So that is the organization that endorses products made in Australia and not just sold in Australia, but obviously sold worldwide. So we're going to hear a little bit about that as well, which is fascinating. The usual thank yous to Gilberto, the podcast boss, for editing all of this together. Also to ask you to rate and review us on iTunes if you get the chance. And finally, if you want to get a hold of me, I am at simon@simondell.com. If you want to email me, or you can find me on Twitter, I am Simon Dell, or LinkedIn, I am Simon Dell. My website, www.simondell.com. Pretty much everywhere with the words Simon Dell. So please come and talk to me. Come and say hello. And if you want to be on the show, if you think you've got an interesting story, especially if you're a business leader, CEO, senior marketing person, CMOs, marketing directors, people like that, people involved anyway in marketing or social media or digital or anything advertising, we would love to hear from you. And as I say, if you've got an interesting story, we'd love to have you on the show as well. So that's about it from me. Without further ado, let's jump in and see the kids at the spin cycle. Welcome to another edition of the Spin Cycle. And this week, Patrick Condren is still away somewhere in the US. And I am joined by the two redheads of the Spin Cycle, Kim O'Gorman from Kim O'Gorman Marketing, and as usual, Dr. Edwina Luck from QUT. So ladies, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Please.
Well, I don't know why I'm saying welcome to the show to you, Ed. You're here every bloody week.
Still, it's good.
You know, it's nice to have Kim back. Kim kind of offers a bit of class and eloquence.
I heard you say that in last week's episode, and I think that's the first time I've ever been told I bring class to anything, so I'm quite happy with that. Yeah.
But let's be honest, Kim, it's a low fucking benchmark. I hear, and Patrick, I've been, for anyone who follows Patrick on Instagram or Twitter or any of those things, he apparently saw Bill Murray this week, didn't he?
That's right, he did, yeah.
And I just want to point out, he saw Bill Murray. He didn't actually talk to him, get a photo with him or anything like that. But, you know, that to Patrick was an achievement, seeing somebody famous.
He said it was pretty up close and personal too. Like it was close. And I went, well, but you know, he's not a fanboy, is he? He's not going to go.
Surely you get that close to someone like Bill Murray. You go, you know, once in a lifetime opportunity, can have a selfie with you, Bill.
You'd
do that, wouldn't you, Kim?
Oh, no. I'm always a bit gutless when it comes to those things. Yeah, I don't want to put people on the spot.
I remember when we did 4BC. Do you remember Ben Elton coming in that time, Eddie?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, yeah. Fangirl. I think my jaw was just, oh.
Okay, it's a really, really bizarre story. I'm just going to divert off on this one. But I did actually get a selfie with him because the other Edwina, who worked there as a producer, spoke to him and said, Simon's English. He's a huge fan of yours. Blackadder days, read your books, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Can he have a photo? And Ben went, yeah, absolutely, no worries. And they took a photo of me and I was wearing a shirt that, I've got to say, did not do my upper body area much justice in the photos. So when I posted it, I had to crop it desperately above my nipple line.
That's what Photoshop's for.
I was at the gym yesterday and with my daughter and the survivor guy who didn't win last year.
No idea. Don't worry.
The cricketer, the Brisbane cricketer.
Izzy, help me out.
Lee. So Lee was there working out and Lee goes to my daughter's cafe all the time. So he said, oh, hi. And I was like, oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Oh, he's so good looking. And I was very good. Sadie went, you were very good, Mum. You actually held yourself together when I introduced you.
Oh, dear God.
I did, but I didn't ask for a photo. I was like, oh, yeah, hi, nice to meet you, thinking I know all about you.
Should have got a selfie.
No.
Right, we're going to start off this week completely the other end of the spectrum from famous cricketers that Eddie's been bumping into in the gym. We're just going to talk about design because we don't talk enough about that on this show. But this week, depends where you class Sunday as, the National Security Agency of the US released a load of old propaganda posters that they used to use internally. And the reason it kind of stood out to me was, number one, there was so many of them. Mm-hmm. And it was about 130 pages if you go to
it. Wow. Pictures you're going to post, Simon.
No, well, I'll post one and then I'll post the link because there is just so many of them. It's, you know, you can't post them all. But the reason I thought it was so interesting was because some of them were genuinely quite terrifying. Mm. And when you think about some of the propaganda or the internal propaganda that, you know, you associate perhaps in the 60s and the 70s with, you know, communist Russia and those kind of things, you don't normally associate that with, like, the West and America. But some of these are actually quite disturbing. Is disturbing the right word?
Oh, well, I'm looking at one now. Don't talk yourself to death with a skull in a spotlight. Yeah.
But then on the other end of the spectrum, there's one with Saturday Night Fever.
No.
So it's like it's not really consistent.
No. It's very bizarre what was going through their sort of head at the time when they were producing these. And I think the one that sort of stood out to me was the one that has got the American Pledge of Allegiance, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom and blah, blah, blah. And instead of the words people in the allegiance, they've crossed it out, put the word state, which seems really menacing to me. But
and somewhat like they would probably be reusing them right about now.
Well, yeah, there is that. Yeah. So I think if people are going to have a look at these and actually, you know, just, I mean, it's classic 50s, 60s, 70s design. You know, back when it was acceptable to use some sort of poor stock imagery and things like that. But really, really kind of interesting what was going through the internal communication of the US government back then. So, but we'll share that one on the, we'll share that on the Instagram page, or we'll share one of them and then you guys can, you know, go and link through to the rest of them. The second thing I saw this week, again, completely other end of the spectrum from that, was the company in, I think it was Boston, wasn't it?
It was Boston.
Who've made a pizza box that turns into a table that you can use in bed.
It's genius.
It sounds like an April Fool's joke, doesn't it? Does. But it's absolutely fabulous. It's from Boston Pizza. And, of course, Boston is the home of fabulous pizza. Well, there is a Boston Pizza. But the way that they're marketing it, though, like, you know, you don't want to have crumbs in your bed and you don't want to have pepperoni on your face when you wake up in the morning. And now we have the solution. That's what I love. They give you the solution and they actually go step by step, seven steps of how to turn the box into a tray.
Kim, when was the last time you ate pizza in bed?
No, I'm not a big pizza in bed girl. I do like a lot of pizza on the couch, so probably more than happy to give it a crack on the couch.
I'm sure you could use the tray on the couch as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's fabulous because I think a lot of pizza companies have tried to do things with the boxes in the past and, you know, have them turn into plates. There was a company that you could break the whole thing down. I think it turned into four plates or something like that, but
That's cool.
And I think it's a great opportunity for branding, but I'm not entirely sure many people will be eating pizza in bed. Maybe that's something that happens a lot in Boston.
I don't know. It was only for Father's Day. That was the promotion.
What's that? What is that trying to say about men?
I know, Simon. I know.
Mums get breakfast in bed and dad gets pizza in bed.
Yeah, actually, that does sound like a
cold
good
Father's pizza.
Day. on a slightly more serious note, Kim, you saw a good article this week about Macy's.
Yeah, so Macy's in the States. Sort of going against the trend of looking for big influencers. So a lot of brands are looking for the, you know, big influencers with lots of followers and the celebrities to create campaigns for their brand. And Macy's have started off looking internally and they're starting up and it is called, as I scroll up to look for it, Macy's Style Crew. And it's open only to Macy's employees. And so they're looking for their own teams to actually be creating content and posting their sponsored content. And if their posts lead to sales, then they're rewarded financially for it as well. And I just think it's a great idea to look at your own team. Two reasons. One, you've got to be a good employer to actually use your staff because if you treat them like crap, then you're not going to get great content. So it probably improves or contributes to the culture.
Yeah.
But also they know more about your brand and they're personally invested in actually making it a success versus someone who's just paid for a couple of posts and move on to the next brand.
Is there anything in the article about how they're actually tracking the sales?
No, it doesn't say exactly how, but it does say that if it leads to sales, they'll be rewarded financially. And they're also saying that they're not only looking for staff members with a big following, and they'll also be providing training to these staff as they're chosen on how to develop their social media voice and improve their own social media presence. So I think it's a great thing to offer if people are interested.
It's wonderful, Kim. I mean, when, as you say, staff are the most important resource in an organisation, which often they're overlooked. And this approach it's so fresh to the influencer thing and, you know, when Style Crew, what a great name. It's such a great name.
There's been other brands that are doing that kind of thing as well, isn't there, Eddie?
Yeah, well, locally in Flight, here in Brisbane, Flight Centre did this last year with their program called 48 Hours. So they did 12 or 13 mini shows and they actually got a travel consultant. Like they asked internal staff to apply for this job. And Greer Gardner was her name. She was she didn't even want to go for the job. And in fact, have you interviewed Luke Wheatley, who's the creator?
Yeah, Luke.
I thought you had Simon.
I think he had a hand.
Yes,
in
he
that,
did.
Yeah.
He did. He was behind that, and he tried to sell that idea to management for years, and he finally got it over the line. And it was such a success. And I think they're rolling it out again this year. So if you Google 48 hours, you'll find that. But you know, as you say, Kim, your internal staff can be your most loyal. And if you can get them on board and get them, like 3M, 3M did this as well, and I think they continue to. The 3M have always paid their staff and asked their staff for ideas. And if they generate and they get into production, then they're rewarded for it.
There's a lot of good companies of examples where staff are really sort of tapped on the shoulder and said, can you help, and things like that. And I know this is not quite the same, but if you ever read stories about how Pixar make their films, is that all of the staff, irrespective of their level of in the company, you know, they could be the janitor or the cleaner or whatever, all the way up to the director, they're all shown the films and they're all given the opportunity to provide feedback and, you know, tell people whether the jokes don't work or the characters aren't, you know, big enough or all those kind of things. So, you know, that's one example. But the other one, I think, which is, I think is closer to me and Kim's heart, was when we used to work at Lion Nathan, and I certainly know I did this, I'm sure Kim may have done this as well, but we were allowed to shout people beers out in the general public if we were in a pub that served Lion Nathan beers.
Oh, wow.
So we had the corporate credit card, and if we were in a bar and there were 60 people in the bar, we could buy them all a schooner of 4X or a schooner of 2Es or whatever it was. Did you ever shout a whole bar, Kim?
Yeah, absolutely. And at the time, because we were so passionate about the brands, and we, you know, when you work for a company like that, you don't drink the opposition's beer. It's almost like it's tainted. And it, so, you know, we were all very passionate about it at the time. So, and also, you know, a great thing to be able to shout.
That's people brilliant. Beer.
Makes you pretty popular on the spot.
Do they still do it now, Kim and Simon? Do you know?
I don't know.
I would. I know that sort of Lion evolved. I mean, when did you leave Lion, Kim?
2014?
Right. I must have gone 2009, yeah. I think. I know, certainly from the sales point of view, that evolved quite like drastically since I'd left.
Yeah.
And I think more controls were put in place for those kind of things, because sometimes people weren't necessarily shouting the entire bar. They might have just been shouting a group of their friends that had no connection to the brewery. So, you know, I'm not to suggest that I ever did that or that I know anybody who ever did that, but I
never heard
I heard these stories around the traps, that kind of thing. But yeah, I think there was a challenge around control of that area. And I think that's the interesting thing I'd say is, you know, I'd ask you guys, do you think that's a potential challenge for Macy's, that if they get 100 odd influencers on board, or however many influencers into their Style Crew, that one of them could go rogue?
I think that's always a risk with any sort of user-generated content or non-marketing department content. So you've got to have a fair amount of trust in your team. I think from the way I read that, they sort of have to be selected, so it's not like anyone can do it.
Right.
So you'd have a level of confidence in the people you're choosing.
Yeah.
But sort of on the note of, you know, how popular you could become if you shout a bar full of people beer, for these guys, I think in Macy's, what's really smart about this is that, I mean, it's content created that they're not having to resource heavily, so it's quite a financially smart decision.
Yeah.
It's giving different looks and feels to it. But also, if they train these people well enough that they become influencers and sort of mini celebrity or Instagram celebrities in their own right, it's potentially driving people in store. And I know that sounds like a big stretch, but if you look at, you know, the lengths people will go to meet Instagram celebrities, and they might not be at, you know, Bill Murray level, but there's still people wanting to meet them and see them in the flesh and get to know them. They're also potentially driving traffic in an industry that's struggling to be relevant. So
I think
it's a great idea.
To me, what would then add on a level of another level to this would be to give those staff the capacity to create deals or discounts on a local level. So when somebody does walk in and said, you know, I follow you on Instagram, or I saw your post about this and that, that the staff member can say, well, look, do you know what? You buy from me today, we'll give you a 10%, or we'll give you an extra shirt, or, you know, something that gives them a
incentive.
Incentives like to actually encourage that sale.
Mm. And so they're not going somewhere else, and that's the thing.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
With retailing, you know, we spoke about, I think, Myers last week, and it's such a competitive playground, and with online getting stronger, this way that they're using their real staff, it's much more authentic. And yes, okay, people know it's an advert or a promotion, but they know it's not a Kim Kardashian or a sponsored content. Well, it's not a big celebrity. So it seems more real.
Yeah.
And it's not just fashion either as well, or the sort of beauty side. One of the examples they had was one of the staff members making Moscow mules, yes, in the, like, the copper mugs that you can buy from Macy's. So it's really, it's not, I mean, it's quite, it looks well produced, like it's not crappy content, but it's still a range of different things. So I'm really interested to see how it pans out. And but what they have said is that it's not that they're abandoning other influencers. It's just another thing they're adding into their portfolio of marketing, rather than just saying no more celebrities, just staff. It's a good blend. I think that's also quite a smart approach.
It reminds me of, and I think the big thing here, and I think, Kim, you said it about 5 minutes ago, is trust. You have to have an element of trust in your staff to be able to execute these things properly, which means to have that trust, you have to have a culture of trust within the entire company. If you don't have that trust, you can't just sit there tomorrow and go, you know what, we're going to do something like this and it'll work. Mm. Because if that trust doesn't exist, it's not going to work. It's going to fall flat on its ass. But this always reminds me of the trust that people like Southwest Airlines place in their crew and their air hostesses and hosts and all those kind of things to do funny, fun announcements, you know, safety announcements, things like that. You always see these things popping up on YouTube every now and again of a host doing, I don't know, rapping it or singing something like that.
Oh, that's great.
And that's Southwest actually encouraging that kind of behavior within their staff, knowing that it could potentially backfire on them at some point, but understanding that the pros far outweigh the cons of these kind of things.
Yeah, it's good. It's a good story, and people love stories. So people love saying, "Oh, I was on a flight to so and so, where New York or whatever it might be," and the host did this really funny rap. You know, and so it tells you, telling people about happiness and about joy and about fun. So there's
using your staff for branding.
It's perfect.
Anyway, thank you very much, ladies. It's been an absolute pleasure and a delight to have you both here instead of somebody old and cranky moaning on for about 20 minutes. but sadly, I think we're going to have him back this week. Anyway. Maybe he might get permanently posted to the US or something like that.
Follow Donald Trump around.
Yeah, can you imagine? Yeah.
Oh.
Christ, do you know what?
I'd like to see that.
Fuck me, that is an interview I would pay. Actually, that's only second to Patrick interviewing Campbell Newman. And for those of you who don't know, Campbell Newman is the former Premier of Queensland and apparently hates Patrick's guts. So that would be fun and that would be highly entertaining.
It would be, wouldn't it? Ooh.
No doubt we're going to see you again soon, Kim, because these two are just so slack, you know, and I know you're there to bail us out.
Thank you for having me on again. Yeah, I like being on the sub team. Yeah.
Cool, thank you very much. Talk to you guys soon.
Bye.
I'm joined today by Glenn Cooper, who I will talk about in chronological order. He is a former business owner for a computer company. He's the former head of sales and marketing for another company that very well known company. He's also the chairman of the Australia Made campaign, but most importantly, he is the chairman of Cooper's Brewery in South Australia. So welcome to the show, Glenn Cooper.
Thank you, Simon. I appreciate the opportunity to have a chat today.
The first thing I'm going to say is one of the other roles that you've got is I think I read that you're sort of described as an ambassador for Coopers throughout Australia and the world. That kind of seems the cushiest job that there could possibly be in the world.
Well, you mean a beer ambassador. You
think a beer ambassador, yeah. That sounds like a really tough gig.
Well, it's sort of, I retired about 3 years ago. I'm still chairman of the company, as you said, but part of my role, you don't ever totally leave a family company. And so, so you know, I part of the work I do a bit of work on export for the brewery into Asia. And I'm an ambassador, as you said, for the brewery. And that's an enjoyable job. But, you know, it means I have to go out to dinner and entertain people with drinks and talk about beer. So it is some work.
And also, I just want everybody to be clear, because we did have this conversation prior to starting the recording is that I do have a experience and history in the beer industry, as people who know me would know that, and I worked for Lion Nathan for about 4 years. I didn't say that prior to that I'd worked for Heineken, and in the UK I used to work for Bass Brewers.
Oh, they were a nice brewery.
So. They were a fantastic company. Yeah. That was where I kind of started my beer career in Burton on. Well, I wasn't actually in Burton on Trent, but that's the oldest trademark in the world, I believe. The Bass trademark. Yes,
it is. And now it's a fabulous, iconic brewery, and I've been there actually. But well, look, after I heard a little bit about you. Being in that beer industry and working for the opposition, I'm still happy to continue.
I've been told by the person who introduced us that you have an interesting story about ducks on rivers.
Ducks on rivers.
There was some sort of large duck on a river or something when maybe he made that one up. Or there was some sort of publicity stunt that Cooper's did.
Oh, no, it wasn't a duck on the river. It was a whale.
Oh, it was a whale. Yes.
During the Lion Nathan takeover bid, which we might talk about later, which is dramatic for Cooper's. There's a very funny story about their polyphene whale, which escaped down the river in a flood, and I purchased the photograph of it and then used it in a kindly funny way.
We'll leave there's it no such thing as now. Kindly funny when it comes to the brewery competition.
Yeah.
All right. The first question I want to ask everybody is, I just want to, your first job, when did you first get paid for doing something? And we've had all sorts of things here, from paper rounds to working in restaurants and that kind of thing. What was the first job you ever had?
Well, probably the first job, I suppose, is when I was studying. I actually studied in electronic engineering. And I will add at one point that when I finished that, my lecturer said to me, "Glenn, you're a very poor engineer, but you've got a big mouth. I suggest you get into sales." While I was studying during that time, I was working at nights at a convention place and serving drinks and food, et cetera. I always did sort of extra work at night to sort of fund the way through. And also it kept you very busy. So I did a number of jobs, and then later on in some hotels, but mainly serving people and just coming out of that area while I was studying.
When you do those kind of jobs with a background from the family that you're from, did that teach you much about the industry, sort of seeing it from that sort of level?
It didn't so-called teach me anything from that far, because back in those days Cooper's was a pretty small brewery, and it was more like just purely parochial South Australia, and look, people would sort of, "Oh, you're part of that Cooper family, why are you here?" That was the question. "Why aren't you working for the brewery?" That was the question. And then an issue point with us, which we're very proud of, is we have a ruling that you can't even come near the brewery till you're 30 years old. That's the minimum you can even talk about. And even then, the board decides if you're allowed to come in based on the fact of experience and quality of the person.
Wow.
So, you that was more the case. It was just, why are you here?
Yeah.
And I said, "I'm here to earn money like you." That was it.
I always get the question with the surname Dell, is that, am I part of the Dell computer family?
And you wish you were.
I said, I often say I wouldn't be talking to you if I was. Okay. So, but your first job, so electrical engineering. What sort of got you there? What was it about that attracted you into that?
Well,
sector?
I knew when I left school I had to do something, and I was sort of very good with my hands, pretty good with the hands, and so and I liked I saw that electronics was just starting up. You know, it was just the very early days of electronics, and I just found that fascinating, and so that's what I went and studied, and then that led to me, running my own, getting involved in computers, and computers nothing like today, getting me involved in computers, but also then getting me involved in my own business, which was a computer sales and service business. And so it all started from me just wanting to do things with my hands and a fascination with electronics.
What was the computer industry like back then? Who was buying computers and what were they using them for?
Well, they were very small computers. And you know, I heard this terminology on TV the other day, floppy disks. And a lot of the young people today don't even, they look at you and say, what was a floppy disk? And,
I remember you know, those, yes.
We had an 8-inch floppy disk. And I always remember in the early days we had a small computer that would run two terminals. And you think, wow, this is amazing.
Yeah.
But the advancement was enormous. But I did start in those very early years. In fact, I even started in my sales career. I sold electronic systems, major systems to weapons research up over here in the RAAF. And this was more electronic system processing because the computers were massive, big systems by IBM in those days. So, you know, I was part of a very fast evolution.
Yeah, I can imagine. What sort of dates was that?
That would have been in. Well, you're getting me my age now, aren't you? Well, that's all right.
I was trying to throw it away for asking that politely. There,
but. No, I'm 67 at the moment, and I'm happy as. So that would have been sort of during the probably 70s, the middle 70s to 80s. Yeah.
Wow.
During that period,
yeah.
And I didn't join the brewery. For people to know, I didn't join the brewery until I was 39.
Right.
I joined in the year 1990. So, you know, I stayed out of it for a long time.
When you decided to start your own business, what was running through your head at that point?
Well, I was actually working for a company which had branch offices all around Australia, a computer company, and I'd been fairly successful in that company. That asked me to come to Melbourne. I was actually living in Melbourne at the time, and I was a distribution manager. I was about 27 years old, about 29 years old, around that mark. And I was in Melbourne, and they said, "Look, do you want to buy our office in South Australia? You come from Adelaide, you know people. Do you want to buy the office?" So I hocked the house. We borrowed against the house.
You married at the time?
I was married at the time.
How did the wife say? I assume you walked through the door one day and said, "We're going to sell the house."
Took a little convincing.
But then
she backed me all the way, and we believed in the business. It was quite a good business at the time. It wasn't a fantastic business, but it was a good business. And so we borrowed and bought that business. And, you know, it took off, and I had some marvellous times during the computer industry, very early days of computers and sales in a service centre as well. We had a service centre. Yeah.
How did you grow that business? What were the sort of key things that you did every day from a sales or marketing perspective? Was it back then just knocking on doors or making phone calls?
Simon, I got to tell you, it's what I did those days – to me today still hasn't changed. It's changed a bit of format, and that is this, that, you know, it was effectively knocking on doors. It was building relationships. It was going down to the universities and building relationships with the people that were making the decisions. It was going out to Weapons Research Centre, which was still a big area in Adelaide here, and getting around all the little departments and talking to people and saying, "Look, this is what we've got to offer." And one thing I can give people during, and it still hasn't changed, understanding your customer was the key. Once I understood how their mind worked, what they were trying to achieve and what was turning them on, then you're able to sell to them a lot better. And it still hasn't changed today in my book, understanding your customer. And I say to our sales reps in the brewery for many times, they got sick of it. You know, shut up, because you don't learn anything by just talking all the time.
Yeah.
You learn by listening. And you've just got to say some good bits and then ask questions and listen, and you will learn about that customer.
It's amazing the amount of conversations that I've had on this podcast with people who have built startups, and even then, the same thing holds true, is that sometimes you just have to make a lot of phone calls and build relationships and knock on doors, irrespective of whether you're a product-based startup or even, you know, software or all those kind of things. The early days is still very much about getting out there in the marketplace and meeting people.
Yeah, well, trust. I think trust builds from face to face.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So, were there some of the sort of marketing things back then? I mean, obviously, you know, in those days, there's no Facebook, there's no, you know, there's no email and those kind of things. Was there other mediums that you would have used to grow the business?
Yeah, well, flyers. We used to do a lot of flyers. Yeah, which is even the case when personal computers came in, we did a lot of letterbox drops.
Okay,
But typically with companies, it was just a flyer and a glossy magazine.
Yeah,
glossies. They weren't fabulous presentations, but they were at least presentations you could leave with people. So those things were very important. Also, believe it or not, going and having drink together was very important. Yeah. Just trying to socialise if you could. And it's fascinating today. I know that with the companies like Coles and Woolworths, they're not allowed, they're prohibited from building relationships with customers. When I say customers, people that sell to them, they're not allowed to build those relationships. And many are quite good, innovative people inside Woolworths and Coles and those companies have actually lost their jobs or been transferred because they built relationships with the suppliers. And I think that's a very disappointing attitude.
I mean, back in the back in my days of in the Ernst Lyon Nathan days, that was that was an intrinsic part of building relationships with hotel owners and bottle shop chain owners is going out and entertaining them. And I sort of use entertaining in air quotes because there were some big nights there.
Simon, during this interview, we've got to make sure you stop. You don't use profanity words like Lyon Nathan. No, only joking. We have a good relationship. We have a good relationship with them.
I think I was going to say, I'd imagine the relationship today is pretty better than perhaps it was in those early 2000s.
It's pretty good. You're out there beating it out, but up in the upper level, more in the executive management level, you're in an industry, we're in the beer industry, there's a lot of other issues of competitiveness that we have to look at. You just don't get silly on it.
I've got a couple of questions around things like pricing and stuff like that, because that's something that sort of interests me over the years of where it was then and where it is now. But we'll come back to that. You said to me you only moved into Coopers when you were 39.
Yep.
What made you switch? Because obviously you must have had a relatively successful business there that you owned. And what sort of made you want to move into I guess it probably still wasn't much of a corporate industry back then with the size of the business back then, or was it starting to kind of grow a bit quicker?
It was starting to grow. Let me just take it back a little bit. When I was growing up and the other Coopers that worked with me, same thing, that around the similar age, we were told as we were children that, look, the brewery won't survive. It's struggling. It's going through some very tough times. And so you really can't make any expectations the brewery will be around. So you better go out and do your own thing. And so that's what we were told, and that's what we did. And it was only in the later years, it was very, very risky time for Coopers, even during the 80s, mid-80s particularly. And it was only that one of my uncles, Maxwell Cooper, who was a brewer, who actually did some breakthroughs on what they call transporting wort. In other words, sterilisation of wort, so you could transport it. And it was the start of the home brew kit. And they would ship the wort, which is a base product of beer before fermentation, and you would ship that in a bag. It was like a wine cask. Well, we developed that. We're the first in the world to develop that, and it took off. And so we were the first to do a home brew kit. It took off, and it saved the brewery.
Yeah.
It was. And so during the 80s, it was saved by that. Then it sort of got a bit of base, but it was only near the late 80s where the fourth generation Coopers sort of thought, well, maybe this will survive.
Yeah.
Maybe we better think about the next generation. So it was myself that was approached, and also my cousin, Dr. Tim Cooper, who was a medico. We were approached to say, look, are you interested in coming into the brewery? And we said yes, and that's when I sold off part of the business and the computer business and joined the brewery, because you'd grown up with it. So it was a deep love there. So the opportunity was there to survive. And so Tim and I said, I think we can contribute to this.
It's a funny thing about that. So there's something about the alcohol industry. One of my early interviews was a gentleman by the name of Justin Dry, who owns a company called Vinomofo, which you may or may not
yes,
know.
Yes, I have. Yep. Yes.
His exposure to wine as an early age is just permeated through his entire life, and when you speak to him, you can't imagine that he would do anything else other than wine. You know, and I can imagine with a, you know, family run business, and certainly in the beer industry, that it's much the same.
Yeah, I grew up with it, was in our family, and you know, I enjoyed the early, I used to wander around the brewery as a young kid. You know, I'd even we can say this now, even help the old man with a couple of tastings on Sunday morning when I was quite young.
Yeah.
So, a little underage, but that we got away with it.
Yeah. Your first role in there was sales and marketing director.
Yes.
What were the sort of marketing challenges walking in there, you know, in sort of day one? What sort of things were you facing that you had to deal with?
Yeah, look, it was a very interesting time. We'd sort of been surviving, and so therefore the amount of marketing, amount of money available was virtually non-existent.
Yeah.
One of the things that I just started to apply, and I still talk about this when I do talks around Australia, is I identified what Coopers had that the others didn't. In other words, with Foster's and Lion, it wasn't Lion in those days, those other big breweries, what did we have that the others didn't? And I call them the Coopers' advantages, and I identify them. And all businesses have some advantage. It may not be readily right there in your face, but we have advantages. And I identified those advantages that the others didn't have. And one of them wasn't money or advertising power, let me tell you.
Yeah.
And so once I identified those, I altered our – we virtually hadn't done the marketing, but I went about building a brand name. And one of the critical areas that I really went to was Sydney, because it was still very much state-based beers.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was starting to open up. And I always remember travelling in a taxi from Sydney Airport. And the common word would be, oh, you know, the taxi driver would say, oh, what do you do? Oh, so I'm in the beer industry. And the next question would be, oh, what beer is that? And I'd say, Coopers. And they'd say, yeah, I've heard of that, but aren't they owned by Foster's, or aren't they New South Wales, or aren't they owned by somebody else? And so what I identified was the fact that actually people had heard of Coopers, but they had no understanding.
Right.
So we set about a plan to make them understand who we were. We had identified that actually they knew our name, quite surprisingly. They knew it. They knew we were a brewery, but they knew nothing about us, where we were and what we were about. So that was the start of using those advantages to then broaden interstate-wise the Coopers brand.
So it was, I guess then, that messaging that you had to bring across was very much that it was Australian, that it was independent owned, that it was family owned. Was that the sort of first step?
Yes, but also the really important step that made a big difference is, remember, it was, our beers are cloudy because they're all natural, no preserves, no additives. And, you know, there was always a bit of a joke from the Foster's people, oh, Coopers don't even know how to filter beer. Well, you know, we went down the path of saying it's cloudy because of the reason, and that's no preserve, no additives, it's a true ale. And we went down that path, and very early days, I got people involved in Sydney of rolling your Coopers.
Yes.
And it was a fantastic thing because it was the theatre of Coopers.
Yeah.
And bar people, we went around talking to bar people and say, this is what you do, you roll it. And they got onto it, and they said, we love this because it's a talking point. And it just took off from there. It was like a every free salesman in a bar rolling a bottle.
Yeah.
And they we gave them the story of why are you rolling it, and it just worked magnificently. And we're doing that overseas now, rolling a bottle.
And I guess when one person at the bar watches the barman do that, they all then want to know what that is, and you know, it's that kind. It's almost a viral effect of the early 90s without the internet.
It was exactly what it was, and still today, you know, I love it when I go through Sydney and Melbourne, everywhere now, and I hear a person ask for Coopers if they're talking about a bottle, and they just, the bar person said, would you like it turned or rolled, or would you like it rolled?
Yeah.
And this is, and mate, it's no good doing that with Forex because it makes no difference, does it?
It's not a lot you could do with Forex to make much of a difference, but... there we go. There's anyone who works with me or has worked with me is now going to delete me off Facebook. There we go.
Oh, I got a bit more left for you yet on this broadcast. Don't worry.
Well, do you know what? We'll save it all up to the end so we can do it all in one go. Okay. So what products were about? What products did you introduce? Because I saw that there was a list of things that you'd kind of overseen or brought into the marketplace. Yeah.
Well, the first one I brought in, a pale ale had been launched, but it was in very early days. It got launched about 80, 89.
Yep.
And I joined in 90. So it was very early days. But so I can't say I was the launcher of Pale Ale. We had Sparkling Ale, Pale Ale, and Cooper Stout. They were the main ones. The first one I did was we had a dark ale that was only on tap in a hotel here called the Cooper's Ale House. And this dark ale was very good, but we'd only ever had it on draft beer. So I put that into a bottle with a new label and we called it Cooper's Dark. And we had a marvellous advertising campaign because our advertising agency here, which was a company called KWP and still is, and a very good person that started by the name of Andrew Killey and Peter Withy, who started it. And they came up with a program and they took a photograph of the chairman of the company at the time, Maxwell Cooper, who I mentioned was the homebrew person, took a photograph of him. They sepia'd the photograph and they put sunglasses on him and they said, "Meet the dark side of the family." It was a fabulous connection. And if I can, with you just for a moment, I'll tell you an amazing story. They showed me the poster and I said, "My goodness, you've put sunglasses on the chairman of the company and you've called him the dark side of the family." I said, "I love the connection, but I just leave it with me." And I waited for a time and we're at the old brewery. Then I was near the bar and I heard Bill and Maxwell Cooper come back from a long lunch. And they seemed pretty happy. So I went in and I said, "I just want to show you an ad. It's not going to be not really, only in a few magazines." And I held the ad up and they both laughed. And Bill said to Maxwell, "I've always said he was the dark side of the family anyway." And so I said, "You're okay if we just print this a few times?" And Maxwell said, "Yeah, that's all right." Well, Maxwell went away up to Singapore on a business trip. And while he was away, we had the opportunity. KWP bought me the opportunity to say, "We can advertise in the back of 260 buses around Adelaide." So we whacked old Max on the back of the bus, right? Only problem is I hadn't told him. And when he came back to Adelaide, he's driving up in a car and there's all these buses with Meet the Dark Side of the Family. But you know what? Today, if he was here, he would put those sunglasses on.
Yeah.
He took that role. And that just launched that product amazingly well with a minimum budget.
That's fantastic. I think smart ideas like that within the beer industry have been you don't see them so much these days.
No, you don't. Unfortunately, no, you don't.
And I think everyone's trying to be. I think often the beer industry tries to be a little bit too clever for its own good.
Absolutely. And, you know, we've tried to stay very similar out of that arena. We try to stay different. I mean, the other products that we launched was Cooper's Clear.
Yep.
Now, that was when an example of what I just said was it was all the other beers were coming out with low-carb beers. Blonde was leading the path, right? They're all low-carb beers. And I said, we can't just follow, but people want a low-carb beer. So we brought out Cooper's Clear, which is a low-carb beer, and it says low-carb on the bottle, but it's not the main presentation. And the way we did that was the fact that everybody said, "Oh, Cooper's, your cloudy beers," and that's all they knew us for. So instead of cloudy, this one was clear.
Yeah.
But by the way, it's low-carb. And it's got a good taste. So that's how Cooper's Clear came about. And we made it, it was low carb. We went after the low carb market, but we did it with a different name.
Was there anything in that time as in the sort of in your marketing area that you look back and just think that was actually a mistake?
Yeah, there was one, but it never got out of South Australia. We came up with a marvellous idea of Cooper's wanted to do a new beer. We want the South Australian people to name it. So we named it. We had a competition. It was 2 business class airfares to London. So it was a good prize.
Yeah.
Name the new beer. And we selected a winner. And the beer name was called Black Crow. And so it was before the Crow's Day, so none of that played into it.
Right. Yep.
Just the Black Crow of South Australia. So it was called Cooper's Black Crow. Well, it came out and it took off. The only problem was it wasn't a very good beer. And it took off and it came down like a plane as well.
Yeah.
And people said, "Love the name, good idea, but boy, it doesn't taste that good."
Yeah.
And so even our brewers today will admit it wasn't their finest hour in making beer. But yeah, that was a failure. But other than that, we've had very little failure, very few.
I was going to say, if you ask the general public to name things these days, you get a much different response.
Yes. That's true.
I just, you know, the old Boaty McBoat face, the general public being asked to name a boat and things like that. I suspect you'd be walking a fine line these days if you asked the general public to do something.
No, you couldn't do it.
What was your all across all that sort of time since you joined the brewery, which would, I guess, what's that now? 28 years.
Yes, 28 years. Yeah.
What's been your favorite brand? What do you look back on and just go, either something you did or something that was there historically? What's the favorite brand for you?
The favorite brand is still Pale Ale.
Yeah.
No question. It is, it's an iconic, it's a massive brand. We sort of started it. We've been followed with the green for Pale Ale. There's lots of Pale Ales around now.
Yeah.
Ours is the Cooper's original Pale Ale. And we just solidified that name in Australia. Now, Pale Ale, we didn't invent the name as such. Pale Ale is a world unified name, come out of England. Typically it was out of England, down the south of England. But yeah, we, in Australia particularly, we're known. People would go and order, and still today they say, I'll have a pale. And most cases, the barmaid would know that that's a Cooper's,
yeah,
because we started it. But there are a lot more today. So Pale Ale is the most iconic one. And just in recent time, and here's the first plug coming in, we've just released Session Ale. It's a blue label now. Okay. There's a typical label like the Pale Ale.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a cloudy beer. It's all the other things, but it's got a tropical taste, a bit more crafty.
Yeah.
And it just has taken off. We are thrilled with it. It's just gone ballistic. And it hasn't robbed from Pale Ale. In fact, Pale Ale drinkers come up to me and say, oh, Glenn, that's pretty nice, that Session Ale, but it's not a pale.
Yeah.
And I say, well, thank you, because we don't want to move the Pale Ale drinkers. No. We want the other drinkers to come and try our Session Ale, which has taken off all around Australia. We're really pleased with it.
What do you think's made the Cooper's brand last the time it has?
Well, the brewery to last is the funniest thing. I mean, boy, I mean, we've been through some torrid times.
Yeah.
And I'll take you back when my father and my uncles were there, and, you know, there were breweries all over Australia. There were Swans. There were just so many breweries. And, you know, they all got on pretty well in those days. They'd all have a drink together. And my father told me, he said, oh, you know, those other brewers, we'd have a brewers conference in Adelaide and all the brewers had come out. And typically the Fosters people said, look, we love you people, but we're going to bury you. And, you know, yeah, they're all gone.
Yeah.
They're all sold. And the sad part, and I mean this seriously, the sad part for Australia when we lost Fosters was it was a world iconic brand for Australia.
Yeah.
And we lost that. But now all of the other breweries other than the craft brewers, they're all owned by overseas companies.
Yeah.
And you know, we're the only largest major Australian-owned brewery. Now, we wear that mantle. We're pleased to, but it was a bit sad when Foster's was sold. And you know, your old Forex, that's owned by Kirin Japanese. So people don't quite understand that we've actually decimated and sold off our beer industry.
I did a brief stint as well with DB Breweries in New Zealand.
Yes.
They're Australian arm, and DB's owned by a Japanese company as well.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, no, they've all. It's sad, but anyway, we're there. When we'll keep going.
Do you think you must see a lot of the sort of new craft brewers that sort of, you know, there must be it feels to me that there's this kind of new wave or new generation of brewers that are starting to come through in Australia. Do you see that a lot in South Australia?
Oh, yes. Yeah, and look, I've seen this craft brewing thing grow out of America when I was doing the US all the time.
Yeah.
In the US, it's gone ballistic. And when I say ballistic, it's going to hurt itself because it's just uncontrolled now.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, so many people have got into it. The quality levels are all over the shop, and you don't know. You know, you can go and buy 20 beers in a, you know, 20 or 40 different beers, and they will all be different, some good, some bad, some average. So that's a bit silly there. Australia's not quite to that level. We've got some good craft brewers. I get asked regularly how we handle the competition because of all the craft brewers. And there's two ways to answer that question. One, yes, there is more competition for Coopers because they're craft brewers, but the craft brewers have grown the pie. Whereas before we were the only craft person competing with Forex and Foster's and all those. But now, and so the craft area or the crafty premium type market was very small. That market has grown. So the pie is growing. There's more players in it, yes. So there's two things have occurred, more competition, but also the pie is growing. So we're still growing. We've still had some good positions. We had something like 20 years of continuous growth. We had a slight dip last year. And that's more to do with drink driving, you know, health, all these issues that are coming in around the world.
Do you, I know this is going to be a hard question for you to answer and you probably might tell me to bugger off, but are there any craft beers out there, or, you know, some of the small ones that you look at and you really, you admire, you think are doing a great job?
Look, yeah, there is. And they come and they go. But, you know, there's, look, I've got to say that there's some products like Samuel Adams, which are American ones. The ones, the craft ones that were started in America many years ago are actually quite sophisticated breweries now.
Yeah.
And they're still seen as craft, but there's still some very good beers. The sort of bigger ones are usually the ones that I would recommend. There's a few little ones that pop out. I mean, you know, we've got some home brewers who brew up our home brew kits, and we've got a new thing called Brew Art now, which is a self-contained brewing, a bit like a espresso machine on steroids. Yeah. It brews beer, and I'm amazed how some of those beers, how good they are. So, you know, the quality and the level of craft brewing has lifted substantially, and they do make some very good beers. So, yeah, there's a few American large companies, but, you know, I taste ones that I go around, and you surprise you sometimes how good some of them are.
You met my friend, colleague, associate, Simon Bell. Very confusing that we both have very similar names. You met him at the Myriad Festival in Brisbane a couple of weeks back, which was a festival of innovation. Where do you see the innovation in the beer industry sort of in the next 5-10 years?
Yeah, you know, it's a really interesting exercise, that, because there's two facts to it. Technology innovation is terrific. That innovation of technology has helped the brewers a lot, because the quality of the product has lifted up substantially. And, you know, innovation, machinery and stuff has allowed the craft beer market to survive, to grow, because you can now, at a reasonable cost, get equipment that can make good, reliable, quality beer. So that part has helped the brewers. The next phase, I'm not sure you can do a lot more technical innovation in beer. It's pretty well advanced at the moment. I think the innovation part comes in how we market, social marketing, you know, how we market. It's a cluttered field, very cluttered field to stand out. We've just been going through some things. I mean, some of the issues come into through now with how you assess through Google, your how you target your consumer. Biggest thing that I call innovation is a bit like the condensation of supermarkets, where they're getting bigger and stronger and they're gobbling up the small liquor stores, because I find that odd, because there's nothing like the good guy in a liquor store who's small around the corner, who you can go down and he's got a little tasting, taste a few beers, taste a few wines. The trouble is the liquor store, those really good innovative liquor store people are being knocked out by, you know, by the large supermarkets, and I think that's a disappointment to me. That's probably my greatest disappointment, is that we've allowed our the government's allowed our supermarkets to have such a stranglehold. In the US, by the way, you can't have on what we call essential services, food and alcohol, can't have more than 19% market share. So I think we've made a blue there, to tell the truth.
I think the interesting thing was, I go into, you know, last time I went into Whole Foods in the US, and you walk into one of those and there is just a huge beer selection in there. And I you know, I'd struggle to recognize any of the brands in there, that, you know, there's no Coronas, there's no Stellas, there's no Buds or a Coors or anything like that. It's all individual beers from, you know, around America and around the world.
Yeah, that's right. Look, and as I say, with the big supermarkets, I'm not crushing, you know, they've got to be there and they offer very good cost-effective food for people, etc. But and I don't have a big problem with how they operate. What I do have a problem with is, unfortunately, they're knocking out all the small the small places. And that's where I think the uniqueness of the small place, I'd love to see. The independent person, I'd love to see survive.
I see that. I mean, I look at some of the innovation in the industry more perhaps as the way that we access the products in the delivery, for example. You see there's been a lot of those kind of, you know, office delivery and home delivery companies sort of cropping up, you know, around the big cities. I think there was one got invested on Shark Tank, or, you know, those sort of things.
Yeah.
So maybe the innovation is, you know, the actual the way the product reaches, you know, you the brewer to the end user, and maybe starts to even cut out that middleman.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a, you know, and I will say one thing, in America just last year, they were taking me to a couple of their sort of liquor stores, like you say, and there were rows and rows of craft beers. And they were putting the beers, they're pulling them out of the four packs and out of the six packs and putting individual bottles.
Yeah.
So the whole rows were individual bottles, and the people were just walking down there with a shopping trolley and taking one of this, one of that, you know, one pumpkin beer, one orange beer, yeah. one this, putting them all in there. They had no brand recognition.
Yeah.
So they there was no brand, and I think that's really dangerous. Where and that'll hurt craft brewers because they've got to survive on a brand. And if you have no brand recognition, then how are you going to survive, or how are you going to market your product? So it's a really interesting thing I saw.
Well, on that note, I mean, there was a question I always thought that I never sort of understood why those big, you know, the First Choices and the Dan Murphys of this world never did sort of a build your own six pack option where mm. you could go in and pick brands that you like. It's interesting you say that picking the individual ones is a, you know, is a lack of brand recognition. I often look at that brand fridge, the craft beer brand fridge, and think, you know, I'd like to perhaps get two or three from different breweries. Mm. If I'm going to drink, a six-pack in a night, which I can't really do anymore. but if I could, otherwise I just snore all night. The wife kicks me out of bed, that's why. But if I could, you know, the option to maybe have two from Cooper's and two from somebody else and two from a local brewery, yeah. that's quite an attractive proposition to me. But I guess that's not attractive to... you know, to the bottle shops.
It's never, yeah, it's not attractive to them. I did it and tested it quite a number of years ago. It was more with our product, have a mixed six pack of ours. Now, we can't manufacture this stuff. It's got to be manually yeah. done. We went to the big stores and we said, look, we can give you a flat pack, carry six pack. We'll brand it up with the brands across the front of it. And they didn't want to do it. No. The reason they don't want to do it is because it meant some labor that their people had to put them into the 12 packs.
Yeah.
And I said, well, like you said, well, maybe just put them nearby and see if they'll pick it up and then they'll put the pack together and then put the bottles in. But they all just said that's too hard.
Yeah.
It's all about fast food almost.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I guess there's, you know, if you're dealing with a sort of a niche part of the market that wants to do that, yeah, it starts to become perhaps, you know, less economically yep. viable. So. It's interesting. The other thing I was going to talk to you just very quickly about was pricing, because when I started in the beer industry in 2003, well, I started in the Australian beer industry in 2003, the price of a carton, and I'll use Heineken as an example because that was who I was working for back then. We'd like to see Heineken in a bottle shop back then at you know, $44 a carton. And you walk into a bottle shop, you know, a First Choice and a Dan Murphy's these days, still $44 a carton. Is there been a struggle to generate more value out of the industry, or has the value come from you know, new technology and innovation and cost saving?
Look, there has been an advantage through innovation with the brewing equipment that has helped, but really the main factor is look, beer's had two things going against it. Well, the main thing going against it is beer excise. It's like cigarettes. Every twice a year, it goes up in excise price.
Yeah.
Fortunately, CPI hasn't risen a lot, but it's growing up. Beer used to be cost effective. It's not so much now because they're up at $50-odd a case. That's not too bad, but when you go into a hotel, boy, it's expensive, yeah. and that's a problem. That's not the hotel. That's just the fact of staff, wages, etc. So, you know, it's getting now. Beer was also a really good cost-effective drink. It's getting away from that a bit now. The issue being there's no, as I said before, there's no more, I don't think, great technology advancements yeah. that's going to save in the brewing process.
Yeah.
So we are going to see the product keep rising. The taxing on the alcohol, I mean, there's a lot of talk in government about, you know, the alcohol levels, you know, what the excise going up being attached to the alcohol, but how much tax you pay is relative to the alcohol. Mid-strength beers have helped that price to hold it. Mid-strength beers have held it, and that's just because the tax is lower. So the taxes, the lower alcohol, lower tax, has kept the price a bit more stable, but it's going to keep going up, and that's a bit unfortunate.
before we move on to the, because I want to ask you a few questions about the Australian Made campaign. I think perhaps we ought to just give five minutes to at least your favourite Lion Nathan story. You get 5 minutes off the hook to say what you like about
Lion launched a hostile takeover bid of Coopers back in 2005 when you would have been around. Vicious battle. That was a very tough battle. It was quite, it cost us, by the way, it cost us $8.5 million to defend.
Yeah.
And we won, which was great. It was a fantastic result, but boy, it was a tough battle. And we learned a lot out of it too. It tightened up our whole organisation, but it's not a battle I want to go through again. It was a very steep and expensive learning curve. But what ended it magnificently, really, was our shareholders. We were able to ask our shareholders to insert a clause in our constitution, and that said no other brewery may own shares in Coopers.
Right.
To insert that, you're effectively asking your shareholders to insert a clause that can limit a very high offering by another brewery, but nearly 96% of our shareholders says insert that clause. This company's been going too long. We want it to keep going. And the final price that Lion offered was $310 a share when our share price was down at about $48 a share. But a couple of years after, probably two and a half years after, our share price with that clause inserted was above the $310, went to $338. So, you know, our shareholders supported us, and that's how we won that battle. But that isn't the story that I think you're probably looking for. The whale you mentioned earlier. Well, you know, they had the Christmas display here, which they do every year down at West End, which was owned by Forex, owned by Kieran now, or the whole lot was owned by them at the time. And they had a Christmas display there they had for years, and they had a polythene great big whale that sat on the river. Well, we had a little flood during that period while this takeover bid was on, and their whale broke loose and took off down the river. And the press got hold of it, the TV, and they took a photograph of their whale just careering off down the river. Well, I said to our advertising company, buy the photograph of that whale. I want to own it. I'm not telling you what it cost. And even the people in the brewery don't know what it cost, but I got it and we owned it. And then we did an ad, and it was a magnificent ad, and it showed that we did a full-page ad. And in fact, we did two ads. And one of them, the lawyers said, if you use a second one, you're going to be paying us more money. So we couldn't use that one. And so the ad was just showed their whale. It just said the freedom to go your own way. We can relate to that. Coopers with a beer underneath. It was a nice feeling ad.
Yeah.
Now, somehow the other ad escaped on the internet. I don't know how it happened, but it did.
I love it.
Anyway, it was a fabulous ad. But I don't know. I don't want to offend anybody because it was a relative to – I'm not going to say it because I don't want to offend anybody other than to say it had a connection between – a whale and the Japanese.
Yes. If anybody wants to know, feel free to email me because I think Simon Bell did tell me what it was. So
this is fabulous that it got out. It was, and I'll tell you what, it was one of the very first true viral emails. It went worldwide. Yeah. It was just amazing. Yeah.
Your role as chairman of Australia Made. How long have you been involved with those guys?
I've been on their board for about 8 years, 7 years, 8 years now, and I've been chairman now for about 4 years.
What attracted you to get into working with them?
Well, I was asked to join it. The chairman at the time was a fellow called Robert Gerard, who was Gerard Industries, Clipsal stuff for years here, and he's a larger-than-life, great entrepreneur and great philanthropist here in South Australia and very well connected around Australia. And he was chairman, and he invited me one day down to his very big luxurious boat with a whole bunch of guests, and they took me down the front of the boat and had a little chat to me, and they said, we want you to join Australia Made. And then 2 years later, Robert stepped out of chairman, came to me and said, I want you to take over as chairman. So very quick terms. So really it was a Robert Gerard plan. But I'm enjoying it. It's a love job, and I'm proud of that. It's the Australian Made, the green, for those that don't know, the green triangle with the kangaroo on it, which is now going to appear on all food with a rating of whether it's how much content inside is Australian owned, Australian Made. And so it had a content bar underneath it. It's it's something I'm really passionate about. I'm very, very passionate about Australian industry. I think Australian industry needs to be supported. Yeah. I think people in Australia need to be supported where they can. I'm not saying you go and pay for the highest price, but boy, if there's a close difference or matching up, if you do buy Australia, do support the rest of the community, and I'm very passionate about that. I don't think we have to do fruit from overseas all the time or fruit from certain areas. If we grow the best stuff, we are a food country, so why don't we actually buy our own food and our Australian-made products?
Do you think it's a good marketing tool for brands overseas?
The Australian-made logo? Yeah. The ones that use it, huge. I mean, there's bed manufacturers. Harvey Norman use it for beds and other products that they're made here. In China at the moment, we did some research, it is massively recognised. Yeah. It is a number of the companies that are using it say, boy, I couldn't do it without it, because it signifies a quality to the Chinese and any of the Asian countries. It signifies a quality point that they feel comfortable with. And we just finished some research done by a major research, one of the biggest research companies in Australia. We had a 99% recognition factor and a 96% trust factor.
Wow.
So they're amazing figures. Yeah.
What do you think it works? Do you think there's some industries that it doesn't work in? I'm just thinking kind of, you know, things like software and stuff like that. Do you think people...
Yeah, that's a bit harder, naturally, because, you know, look, it's hard, it's better in food, naturally. But, you know, even some of bed manufacturers, I go back to, there's some terrific bed manufacturers here, H.R. Beard, the bed manufacturer in Sydney. They use it extensively. And, you know, it's a recognisable factor that they trust. Yeah. Comes back in those things to trust. Do I trust this product? Well, that they're wearing that logo. And by the way, we can take the logo, tell a company to take the logo off if their quality goes terrible and they're getting bad reports. Okay. So we can say, look, you're not supporting the logo properly.
What are some of your favourite brands that you've worked with under that are doing well overseas? I mean, you mentioned the bed guys. Is there any others?
The beds guys. All the furniture guys. You'd be surprised, a lot of furniture. Just put food aside, because the food guys just love it, right? Yeah. But they do a huge amount. But, you know, a lot of the manufacturers are quite small companies. I mean, in some of them, we have a sliding scale. You pay to use the logo, and some of them are $500 a year. That's all it costs you. And they say, wow, for $500, I'll put it on. And then they come back and say, I'm surprised how many people know it, because it's a recognisable factor. So now all the food going into, say, China will have it on. You do a product then that's not food and it's got the same logo. Well, there's an immediate connection, and people say, oh, that's from Australia. You know, all the food, that's good quality. So it's not a love factor, but it's a comfort factor.
I was going to say.
And a number of manufacturers.
What do you think it is about the Australian made products or Australian grown products that Chinese like so much?
I think we're good at a lot of things, and sport plays a big part of that. We're good at sport. For a small country, we punch above our weight, and I think that's what people like. You know, another brand that's just come on board with us, Volvo Trucks, because a portion of the trucks are made in Australia. Okay. I didn't know that. Volvo have a great branding for us now. And, I mean, those sort of things are really good. So I think it's a little bit of a trust factor, feel good. You know, these days with competition, any little edge can count.
Yeah. And it's interesting, I think, certainly in the manufacturing industry, certainly in the last few years, manufacturing things overseas, you know, in the Chinas of this world, because the middle class has grown so drastically in China, that the cost savings are potentially still there, are just perhaps not as good as they were, say, 10 years ago.
No, correct. And the other thing is too, like when we put beer into China, right, and our guy in China that puts it in there, he said, it's the young people, they want to step up. And the way they step up, because they've got a little more money, is to go and buying an imported beer, or being seen drinking an imported beer is a step up. And that's a factor, that's how you market. Well, it's not the cheapest, it's not going to match the local brew's price, but you're important. And he said, that's what I see. They want to step up and close, drinking and eating, and that's what's happening with that class.
It's funny, because that was perhaps Australia, you know, 15, 20 years ago, everyone wanted to be seen drinking imported beers, the, you know, the Heinekens and the Becks and the Stellas. And now people want to be seen drinking, you know, those local products, you know, local craft beers.
Well, let me give you the example. When my father was, when I was very young, my father, he would be, there'd be a guy in the bar, two guys in the bar, best mates. One would be drinking 4X, the other would be drinking VB. Neither one would drink the other's beer. They'd both say one was better than the other and they wouldn't change. Right? And, well, I mean, the other thing I could say, if you want to call VB and 4X beers, but anyway.
Oh, go on.
There's
the
second shot. There's the second shot. But what happens now with the people, the repertoire of the people now today is six, seven beers. Different. They're not afraid to move around.
Yeah.
And I think that's great. I think that's fabulous. So, you know, people say to me, oh, I tried yours and I tried somebody else's pale. And this is great. This is what we should be about.
Yeah. I think certainly with my selection of beers will range from, you know, and again, I'll probably get beaten up about this, but, you know, I'll drink a Japanese beer, you know, an Asahi or a Sapporo or something but I'll also drink a locally brewed craft beer. And I think the things I won't touch anymore is those kind of the big mass manufactured ones, you know, that.
Yeah, well, that's what's happening. Oh, I'm glad you mentioned Sapporo, by the way, because people may not know, but we actually distribute Sapporo in Australia, and we make Sapporo in Australia. We actually make their, under license, make their brew. And, you know, and I've got to say, the Japanese make some very good beer. Asahi and Sapporo are very, very good beers. I mean, if you ask me, I say, well, do I drink an opposition beer? Yeah. I'll drink an Asahi. It's a very nice, clean. I think some of those beers
When you go to Japan, and I went to Japan a couple of times in the last sort of 12 months, again, when you see what they're doing there and some of the local beers there, it's just, there's some really, really, you know, good brands coming out of that, you know, that area.
It's a fun place, Japan. Some people have a perception about Japan, massive crowd, small country. But, gee, they're a friendly,
they're crazy,
fun people.
They're bonkers,
it's
all
a
of
lot
them.
Of, it's, I didn't say that, but you did.
I was in the country. I'm just going, this place is just, it's just... I said to my wife, I said, you genuinely feel like if there was a different, if you were on a different planet, it's, you know, it's just, anyway, I could sit and go on about that for hours. Okay. Last three questions for you. You've mentioned a couple of these already, but the last three questions I asked, the first one is some brands that you like outside of your industry, things that you are, that you look at and go, I'd always buy that. It might be a, you know, travel company, it might be a car, clothing, you know, retail, whatever it is. Some of the brands that you really like yourself.
Just brands, look, there's some wine brands I've seen have done a fantastic job. Wine's also fascinating. I mean, I'm not just stuck on beer. I enjoy my wine. I tell you what I've really been fascinated by in the alcohol industry has been the evolution of gins, the gin places. And you go to a couple of country towns now, they have a gin warehouse, and you go in and there's four or five little different gins, and you have a little bit of food, and that's fantastic. It's a tourist attraction. They've marketed those gins, and you've got these high quality gins that are coming up, as well as the scotches as well. Other products, I mean, you always look to, I always look at cars. I'm a bit of a car man. I look how they market. The changing trend of how they've marketed cars is amazing. That is the evolution of marketing.
What would be your favourite car brand? What do you drive at the moment?
Look, I have an Audi. I have an Audi car. My wife has a Range Rover, small one, the little one. But I do have a toy, and I've got it second hand, just so you know that, Simon. I didn't buy it new. But I love my cars, and I've had an Aston Martin DB9, which is an older one. Not too old, but I also had an old car I did up years ago, which was a Corvette Stingray, 1972 454 big block. My wife hated it. She said, there's no airbags, there's nothing, it rattles, it's noisy, and everybody looks at you. And I go, yeah, that's because it's a great car. I said, they're not looking at you, they're looking at the car. But so brands like, you know, iconic brands. I mean, quickly have a look at Mustang, what Mustang have done today in bringing back an old model style, revamping it, and it's taken off in Australia.
What attracted you to the Aston Martin? Because I think that's a beautiful brand. It's a classic, you know, classic brand. But what was...
It, It's one of the best brands you can ever get in the world. It's not the fastest car in the world. It's not this. It's not going to run. But it has that uniqueness. When I drive it around and pull up, people say, oh, can I have a photograph? And I said, yeah. And a lady comes up and the kids around it, and can we have a photograph in front of it? And I said, well, you can sit in it if you like. Well, it's over the moon. Now, you know, I may offend the Porsche owners here. There's lots of Porsches. But guess what? If there was an Aston Martin and three Porsches, the people go to the Aston Martin and have a good look. It's an iconic brand, and they haven't destroyed it, and I hope they never do.
Second to last question. What have you got planned for the rest of the year? What's next on either your agenda or Cooper's agenda?
Well, I'm still heavily involved in the brewery. I'm a number of boards. I'm actually on the. I've been asked to join some boards as an independent board member. One of them, Bundaberg Ginger Beer.
Okay.
Very exciting company. Really going places, especially overseas. Their export market is huge. Fabulous family company. Another company I'm on the board of is Hames Paints, a paint company out of Ballarat. Hames. They are just their second, third generation companies. And they're fabulous to work with. And I just get an absolute buzz out of seeing family companies grow and get stronger. And that's what I love doing, and that's what I feel it turns me on, is seeing Australian family companies grow.
What makes the paint company so special?
Well, they're different. They got a very high premium quality paint. But it's, again, it's the old thing, just like Cooper's. They're a family company. They stick by quality. They have certain rules. The other paint companies are all being gobbled up by the Duluxes, and they're all international companies. Yet they carve out a growing proportion of paint. But by being more family friendly and attached and trusting, they've got their own shops now. They're building a network around Australia. That type of thing attracts me to those, and that's what I hope always survives in this country.
Do you find those smaller companies as well are more agile in their, you know, ability to, you know, be innovative and create new products?
They are. They have to be. That's the success of a family or private small company and private small company. You've got to be agile. You've got to be innovative. And as I said right early in our interview, I just said you've got to find the things that the others don't have.
Yeah.
You know, I have a slogan I say to people quite often. I said one of our advantages is the difference with Coopers is you can still meet a Cooper.
Yeah.
After the day, you might say big deal. But it's something we make ourselves very accessible, very accessible.
Last question. If anybody wants to talk to you, ask you a question, if they need you as a guest speaker, or they just want to hang out with you, Glenn. What's the best way for them to get in contact with you? And for God's sake, don't put your phone
number. Look, no. It's more that I've got an email, but I mean, a lot of people want to come and have free beer, and I am retired to a certain degree. Look, basically, they can write to me. They can write to the brewery, and me. I go to the brewery regularly. I'm always there, and I'm chairing the boards. And I do respond to emails that come in through that way, but I've probably got to say instead of my personal email address, because I get inundated like the phone number. But all I'd say, if people want to chat about something, that I'm very open I'm busy. I'm still busy. I still enjoy helping people. I enjoy people being innovative and trustworthy and forthright in trying to do business in this country.
Fantastic. And just for everyone's benefit, if you are interested in Glenn as a speaker, and hopefully after listening to him for the past hour, you will be. You're listed on Saxton's website, aren't you?
I'm a number of them. A few of them put my name on there. They do. It's a sideline. it's not a job. So I do a few, but I enjoy it. You know what, Simon? My drug is the fact when I can talk with about a whole bunch of people and you hear a pin drop, then they come up afterwards and want to ask questions. That's what really gives me a buzz these days, that I can hold their attention and they get something out of it. And family companies come up to you afterwards and say, gee, I got something out of that. That's really good. Thank you.
Mate, thank you very much for your time today. I will promise you that I will go out and buy a six-pack of Cooper's beers tonight. and I'll be rolling them on the kitchen counter, and the wife will be looking at me like I'm an idiot. But
go out and try the new session ale. See what you think. I'll be interested to know, Simon. Are you give me a feedback, because you've been in the beer industry. Give me a feedback on what you think the session ale is like.
I'll get the guys who do the spin cycle segment before we do the interview, Patrick Condren and Edwina Luck from QUT. I'll get them a six pack as well, and we'll all do a session. Maybe we'll record the spin cycle after we've each had a six pack of beer.
Well, send me a photograph, Simon. You're going to send me a little photograph. You know, you got me. You got my email. Send me a photograph and let me know. I've got to see this picture. The old Lion Nathan rep.
I know.
Heineken rep having a Coopers. I'll put that on the wall. Hey, thank you very much for the opportunity, Simon. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I hope it all works very well for you.
Cool. Thank you very much, mate. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye.
That's it from me. Thank you very much. That is Simon Delt Show 28 wrapped up for this week. We really appreciate you listening in, and we hope you'll get the chance to tune in next week. As ever, please rate and review us on iTunes if you get the chance. Otherwise, we'll see you next week.